listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The Black Hills National Forest is at a crossroads. Forest Service researchers have called for a reduction in logging. Members of the Forest Advisory Board disagreed with those researchers and recommended an increase in timber sales. Jim Furnish is former deputy chief of the U.S. Forest Service. His memoir, Toward a Natural Forest, chronicles the evolution of the U.S. Forest Service and his personal awakening to a new forestry ethic. He's in the Black Hills this week to bring attention to the research and to urge the public to embrace stewardship of America's public lands. He stopped by the SDPB Sioux Falls studio on his way to the hills.
My dad was a geology professor at the University of Iowa, and they held a summer field camp for geology students to give them some practical, you know, knowledge of field geology. We used to hang out at a little motel in Sturgis, South Dakota every summer and would pile in the back of my dad's Willys Jeep pickup. And I just have such treasured memories of the Black Hills of my youth. You know, a couple of real hallmark events. I remember we had traveled on to Wyoming and even further to meet up with some graduate students of his when the famous Deadwood Fire of 1957 hit, and I remember listening to the reports on the radio, and we drove into Deadwood the day after the fire when the trees were still smoking, and I remember my dad remarking, well, we need to have our shovels ready in case they ask us to volunteer. Well, That didn't happen, but it was such a dramatic turn of events in Deadwood in 57 when they had that fire that almost consumed the town, and then they've had replications of that in more recent years. And then I was working in Deadwood, South Dakota, my first job there on the Black Hills in 1971, 72, when the big flood hit Rapid City. And that hallmark event and what an incredible impression that made on me, the power of nature. And then when I moved to Rapid City after that and worked on a lot of flood restoration, I later became deputy chief of the U.S. Forest Service from 1999 to 2002 when the Jasper Fire struck the southwest part of the hills. And I remember getting very involved in the aftermath of the Jasper Fire. And yes, it's true, the hills have always had a kind of a treasured place in my heart.
Your book is really, it is a memoir, it is a story, it is also an awakening for you as a member of the Forest Service. It's a painful transition that you go through. It's difficult to watch. You wrestle with it. You love it. You're critical of it. All these things kind of unfolding. Talk to me a little bit about your personal journey in the early days and, you know, getting out the cut to the 70s and 80s, you know, dealing with the environmental movement and some legislation in Congress, and then really facing this idea. And I know this is what the whole book is a journey of, but I'm asking you right now to, you know, to sort of sum that up. But facing that yourself personally must have been just a tremendous personal challenge, trying to figure out what is my work in the world.
Well, it was not lost on me early in my career that the Forest Service had two major elements of business. One was putting out forest fires, which almost everybody got involved in. The second was logging. And so when I went to the Black Hills in the early 70s, that was the major part of my business, was helping with the whole logging process. And the Black Hills had been logged over several times. I was part of the machine. I drank the Kool-Aid. I was totally on board with all of that. But there were still some stirrings of unrest. And I remember telling the story of a Jim Hagemeyer, who was a landscape architect who came to run the timber program, who kind of infected us with some new ideas about maybe everything that we were doing was not quite copacetic. And then I think a real turning point for me was when I got involved in processing protests or appeals of land use plans from all over the United States. And I really began to awaken to the unrest of how fed up so many people were with the way the Forest Service was stewarding their public lands. Then I moved to the Oregon coast, right on the heels of the spotted owl crisis, when everything, the House of Cards, came tumbling down. And then I was very much involved in trying to restore some legitimacy to the Forest Service mission there, and actually had quite a good deal of success. But this required turning my back on much of Forest Service dogma and history, and really recognizing that we had lost the battle in terms of our social contract with the public we served. And then I became deputy chief during the Clinton administration, and got involved in some really notable accomplishments. Was still deputy chief when George W. Bush was elected, and I became expendable goods. But I remained a pretty staunch environmentalist, and as you noted, I have tried to fashion myself as a loving critic of the Forest Service, trying to operate from within the bureaucracy to make some changes with some success. But I still look back, it's been 20 years now, and I lament that so little has changed.
Yeah. Go back to Jim Hagemeyer. Jim Hagemeyer?
Jim Hagemeyer.
Because he is this landscape architect who has this idea that maybe you shouldn't cut down some trees because they're pretty. Because there's an aesthetic quality to it, which today in South Dakota we would say, tourism. So help us understand some of the ideas that he was bringing that were so, you know, almost offensive to other members of the Forest Service, but that also made you say, wait a minute, maybe he has a point that there is another role for some of the forest other than timber.
Jim came to a timber management organization as a landscape architect with a pretty fresh view and perspective that was really outside the mainstream. And I think he embodied that clash between seeing trees as products and seeing trees as beautiful and emblematic of why people value mountains and forests. And I would say that it's not lost on me that the Black Hills is really treasured by people throughout the Dakotas and even the whole nation. And so Jim was saying, we need to start seeing the forest from the standpoint of a lot of these visitors who come to see beauty. They drive for pleasure. They like to immerse themselves in a beautiful Black Hills. We need to be mindful of our logging practices, that we pay attention to sustaining and holding on to that as a primary value, not just producing wood. And the way you would manage a forest to just produce wood is different. And I saw this slow turning, I think some recognition that that really had importance and value, and even dating back to the Custer expedition when George Custer visited the Black Hills prior to his death at the Little Bighorn, he brought a photographer with him. These iconic photographs from the 1874 era really told a picture of what the Black Hills used to look like. And I saw a slow turning, trying to build management regimes that mimicked or tried to emulate this natural order, which was very different than just producing wood. And actually took some encouragement over the last 20 or 30 years to see what was happening, the evolution of timber management on the Black Hills National Forest, and now to be so dismayed at what I've been seeing for the last few years, this seeming like reversal or U-turn back to just mining the hills for timber production. It just seems so fundamentally wrong and abusive to common sense.
You can't just cut down, plant new, cut down, plant new. Then that's a farm versus a forest. Tell us about what happens to the diversity of the ecosystem. Help people understand.
For people, your listeners who visited the Black Hills, I would describe them as almost a monoculture of ponderosa pine. And it's very favored by low elevation, fairly abundant rainfall, deep soils, and a good growing climate for ponderosa pine. So it makes it fairly easy if you want to grow trees for timber. And the temptation would be to devote yourself to that so that, in a sense, the forest becomes a kind of a monoculture and targeted at looking at trees, just producing wood and wood fiber. And when you do that in a kind of tunnel vision, you begin to lose so many other features of the forest, which are so important in terms of water quality, scenery, fisheries, biodiversity, old growth forests. There are so many features of a forest that have such astounding value. And I would argue that more recently we become aware of climate change and carbon stores. The Black Hills is a prodigious sponge of atmospheric carbon. And so when you have that tunnel vision focused on timber, so many of these other things are diminished. And a lot of the thesis of my book and my own personal ethos is that you can have timber also and manage the forest in a humble, thoughtful way that aspires to accentuate all these other values too. But you can't go about it greedily. You just can't be so consumed with timber production that all these other values are forsaken.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. My guest is Jim Furnish, and the book he's referring to there is called Toward a Natural Forest. And Jim, I want to bring you back to, you know, why you're here now in South Dakota, because the recent Forest Service report has been another, you know, public battle. Catch us up to where we are at today and what's happening now in the Black Hills National Forest.
I'd start by saying I was a little shocked to learn that in 2019, the Black Hills National Forest, out of 150 national forests nationwide, harvested more timber than any other in the U.S. That was mind-blowing to me. This is not the Pacific Northwest. It's good timber country, but that made me think, what's going on? It was one of the reasons I think we, with the Trump administration, where we saw such a focus on trying to restore commercial utilization of a lot of our natural resources. People think of oil and gas and logging, and that type of thing is emblematic of that. But there was something happening on the Black Hills that really caught my attention. I was contacted by a couple of friends there and started paying attention to some of the news reports and photography. It's so great now with drone videos and this kind of thing. And was just shocked to see some of the timber harvesting practices that were occurring there recently. The Forest Service, thankfully, a research branch, completed this general technical report that took a whole look at what was the volume of timber, how much harvesting was going on, what was happening with things like fires in the Black Hills, the bark beetle epidemic, and all this kind of thing, to reach the general conclusion that the logging that was occurring now is simply unsustainable. And I'm talking like magnitudes of three times as much. So they've been harvesting up to 200,000 100 cubic feet. And the general technical report said that they needed to be like at 60,000 or less to be really sustainable. And my thought was that 60,000 level is really returning the Black Hills more to the type of logging when I was there and more recently, even in the 1990s and that type of thing. So what had stimulated this huge ramp up? And a lot of it was associated with salvage logging of some fires and also the bug mortality. They were harvesting dead trees, but they were also very aggressively mining the green timber, the live standing timber. And then to see the way in which they were doing it with these huge overstory removals where they were taking out all the biggest trees and this kind of thing. I just thought, you know, this requires some response, some action on my part. So, yeah, we're going out to the Black Hills to meet with some recent retirees and some environmentalists to try and shine a light in some dark corners, because I've just reached the conclusion that right now what's going on, the Forest Service is breaking the law, and they're being quiet about it. And this is the time for outspoken advocacy about what's good and right for the Black Hills.
What law are they breaking?
Well, for one, the National Environmental Policy Act, it's been discovered by some of the environmental groups that actually monitor their activities that they're harvesting outside areas that have been properly and thoroughly analyzed for their environmental effects. That's just a classic blunder. You just don't do that. You just don't go logging areas that you haven't carefully analyzed. Also, the Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act, which was passed back in 1960, requires that the Forest Service log only at that level which can be sustainable in perpetuity. And so this general technical report clearly shows that the levels that they've been logging at are not sustainable. In fact, they basically, the technical report said, if you keep logging at that level, there won't be any trees left in the Black Hills in 50 years. Now, I'm not concerned about that happening, but it certainly strikes me that the general technical report is an alarm that's saying to the Forest Service, you have to restore some sense of normalcy. You have to cut back on the logging levels that you've been pursuing for the last several years.
And then you talked about the social contract, which you write about quite eloquently in your book, this idea, and go back and just indulge me, if you will. And there's a story about, you know, Teddy Roosevelt just on the floor with maps spread out. You know, this social contract comes from where? Because Roosevelt's on the, you know, face of Mount Rushmore for a reason.
You remember when Ken Burns did a series on the national parks?
Yeah.
And the subtitle was America's Greatest Idea.
Yeah.
Well, the national forests are not maybe at the same level in the public consciousness, but I think they were America's second greatest idea in terms of a conservation legacy.
Mm-hmm.
Because the national forests actually are much larger. 9% of the continental United States is national forest. And fully, if you add up all the federal lands, parks, Bureau of Land Management, National Wildlife Refuges, do people realize that a third of the United States belongs to them as public land, federal public land? It's really remarkable. Well, along with this stewardship privilege comes, I think, a social contract to try to pay attention to what is desirable, even palatable, to the public that we serve. And going back to the environmental movement, the hue and outcry throughout the 70s and 80s about people were just so violently upset about what they were seeing on their public land that the Forest Service lost credibility. They lost respect. And this was kind of the real crisis of conscience I had when I was working following the spotted owl crisis, was to try to restore some sense of respect and credibility with the public. And we succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
But it really required turning our back on what was and creating a whole new menu for ourselves.
All right. So it's our land. What do we do next?
Yeah. Well, I will say that, South Dakota is a staunchly Republican state, as is Wyoming, where the Black Hills resides, including the areas up around Devil's Tower and Sundance and that kind of thing are considered part of the Black Hills National Forest. They've really held sway for the last few years with kind of putting their political imprint on federal management of the Black Hills. So we've seen this reemergence of logging and support of timber industry. But to me, it's come at a sacrifice of some of the environmental values and the other characteristics of the Black Hills that South Dakotans treasure. And so we're going to try and put a spotlight on that and restore some balance.
You close your book with this idea of optimizing, not maximizing, and the Green Manifesto in our future, and it left me feeling optimistic about the Black Hills National Forest in particular, but then it also brings into stark relief how important this conversation that we're having right now is, because the end of your book is not the end of the story.
How true. Yeah, I really believe that, that maximization is usually a function of greed, which is a great temptation in capitalistic societies. And there's always been this partnership between the Forest Service as a federal land manager and the users of those lands, whether they be recreationists or whatever, as well as the commercial interests, which includes the logging community. And so working out this partnership in a way that really speaks to why the public values our national forests to me requires that we not maximize things like timber harvesting, but that we optimize so that it fits in and it's nested and blended with all the other values and uses, which nowadays really must include carbon sequestration. So you can't just be cutting down all the trees, because when you do, there goes the capacity of the land to store carbon, and that's really crucial nowadays.
Let's take a moment now to reconsider the Rapid City flood of 1972, but this time from an ecological lens. For this conversation, we're going to stay with our guest, Jim Furnish. Furnish was a forester for the Black Hills National Forest during the flood. He was in Deadwood when the skies opened up. He told me about what it looked like in the forest when the rains subsided.
You know, this day lives so crystal clear in my memory. I remember we had been in the woods that day on a road review, and leaving the woods that day, we saw this tremendous thunderhead. I mean, I had never seen a thunderhead so huge on the western horizon. And I remember we were down at the Old Style Saloon having some beers with a friend of mine, Harley, who was the band director in the park. He was from Idaho. And I remember Harley and I went to the door that evening frequently, just in awe of the incessant lightning and thunder and rain. It was just torrential. And then I remember going to bed that night, waking up early the next morning, flipping on the radio, 58 dead in Rapid City, and just shocked. And then listening as the radio, where the death count just kept climbing and climbing. And so this was the feature of the story of the flood, and yet the impact of the floodwaters up in the hills was from a biophysical standpoint was also quite remarkable. And then I got involved for the next year or two in a lot of restoration activities up in the woods. And for me, the magnitude of seeing how water affects an environment and the Black Hills, particularly the road system, especially with a lot of the valley bottom roads, was exposed as a real liability. I was driving the freeway from Rapid City up towards Sturgis, and I had looked at Little Elk Canyon, and I saw this a boulder field that had been strewn out on the prairie by the floodwaters. And I do remember looking not west, but to the east side of the freeway, even farther from the mouth of Little Elk Canyon, seeing even larger boulders from a previous unknown flood, you know, lost to time and history. And I thought, well, this flood was of such epic proportions that, you know, you really get a revelation of this is how canyons are created, you know. Mm-hmm.
In August, SDPB shines the spotlight on forest management. We'll talk forestry and firefighting, recreation and history as we explore the sacred Black Hills National Forest. Ahead of the program, South Dakota Home and Garden, we talk gardening and growing with Eric Helland. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.